Backs are behind us. Unchained Melody, 7-inch. Tunyi Oyelana. Fine compilation, or fine collection of his material. Two CDs called A Nigerian Retrospective, 1966 to 1979. We heard Iwo Ko La Dami, and we open that set with Italian Prague from 19, collected between the years 1974 to 1977. The band Sensations Fix, Barnhouse Effect is the track we heard. Music is Painting in the Air, 1974 to 1977. My name is Scott. I thank you for staying tuned with me today. I'll see you next week. Stay tuned to Freeform Radio, WFMU in East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope Worldwide, WFMU.org. Stay tuned. Benjamin Walker's Too Much Information is coming right up.
Hello, baby. Hello, baby. Want a kiss? Hello, baby. Want a kiss? Hello, baby. Want a kiss? Hello, baby, want a kiss? Hello, baby, want a kiss? Hello, baby.
think you can fully understand what's going on with Facebook until you visited the place.
So you're hanging out at Facebook now?
Yeah.
Why?
I've been doing some consulting for this internet startup drone security firm, and we just took a site visit to Facebook.
So what is it like there?
It's like a cliche of a cliche of a cliche. I mean, it's, you know, kids riding scooters and playing games, and there's food everywhere, and it's an open floor plan. It's all that stuff. And so my group is going into the conference room for a meeting, and I'm like, hang on, I'll be in there in a second. I gotta ride one of these Razor scooters around.
Why?
Just always wanted to do it. And they're like, okay, we'll see you in there in a minute. So I get on the Razor scooter, and I'm just kind of touring the place. And it's like a candy station at Whole Foods. You know, it's like this whole aisle of candy, right? There's pinball games, and just, you know, all this kind of crap, right? And I'm just kind of overwhelmed by it. I'm just looking around at everything. And finally, at one point, I just like kind of crash into this desk. And I knock this bobblehead doll on the floor. And I pick it up, and it's a Mark Zuckerberg bobblehead doll, right?
Who working there would have a Mark Zuckerberg bobble doll?
I know. I'm thinking this exact thought. And right then, Mark Zuckerberg walks up, and he says, that's mine. And I'm just like, you know, this is kind of awkward. And I realize, right, all my team is in the conference room. So I say, you know, hi, Mr. Zuckerberg. I'm with the drone security group. The rest of the team is in the conference room. And I was just goofing around. I'm riding around your office, taking a look around. But I suppose we should go ahead and head in there. And he says, no, this is great. I'd much rather talk to one person than the whole group. I don't really like formal meetings. Why don't you and I blow this meeting off and just the two of us go up to the roof and talk? So we go up on the roof, and, you know, I start to explain about the drones and, you know, the different options that they maybe want to look at.
Wait a minute, though. You haven't explained the drone part yet.
Oh, well, Facebook's buying some drones.
Oh.
Yeah, but as I'm explaining this stuff to him and I'm getting into the details, I can just tell I'm losing. He's kind of shuffling around. He's staring up at the clouds. He's just kind of, you know, he's stretching. Finally, he just says, listen, I know this is important and I appreciate you telling me this stuff, but I think we're in good shape. The guys in the boardroom are going to work that out. I'm not concerned about that. Actually, I have something a little more important that I'd like to ask you about. I say, sure. Have you seen The Social Network? And I say, yeah. Well, let me ask you this. What's the obvious difference between me and my character in the movie? He's expecting me to say something, and I'm like, well, I would say, first of all, you don't have that kind of annoying staccato way of speaking and that the character did in the movie. And he's like, yeah, exactly. And therefore, I did not have any trouble getting chicks. I mean, I actually got laid more than anyone else on my floor at Harvard.
So he's basically proving that he is the guy that was depicted in the movie.
Well, obviously, this is something that's still bothering him. You know, he's still dealing with it. So I say, yeah, but look, I mean, you triumphed over, like, these two rich jock dudes, like the Winklevoss twins, and you totally smoked them. I mean, it's an awesome story. And he was like, that's not even the way it happened.
What?
Yeah. He said, you want to know the real story? And I'm like, yeah? So he looks around and he says, I didn't get the Facebook idea from the Winklevosses. I actually got it from Klaus Schwarzenegger.
Who's Klaus Schwarzenegger?
According to Zuck, Klaus Schwarzenegger was born and grew up in East Berlin. His dad was actually in the Stasi. And one of his earliest memories when he was five is that the wall came down in East Berlin. And he remembers his father coming into his room and the tears in his eyes, dismantling all these spy devices, right? He's pulling microphones out of his toy wagon. He's pulling a camera out of the teddy bear. He had installed all of these spy devices to spy on his son and the whole rest of his family. And now that the wall was down, he didn't have to do that anymore.
Wow.
So according to Zuck, what Klaus took away from this was that having a society like that where everyone is spying on each other is just the worst possible way to go. It's so taxing and draining, and it erodes society. Nobody trusts each other. And, you know, in fact, it eventually led to his father being executed as a war criminal. So Klaus Schwarzenegger's dream, according to Zuck, is that he wanted to create a software platform that would obviate spying, that would take the secret police out of the equation, basically by making everyone more open and essentially spying on themselves. What you're doing, where you're going, what you're wearing, who were you hanging out with? What were you listening to? What were you talking about? All of that information is just made available voluntarily by everyone.
So Mark Zuckerberg tells you on the roof of Facebook that actually he did not steal the idea for Facebook from the Winklevoss twins, but he stole it from a East German exchange student named Klaus Schwarzenegger.
Klaus Schwarzenegger. Yeah, that's right.
But how come Klaus never sued?
So I asked Mark that question, and he just kind of laughed and said, you know, it was amazing. That's the best part about it, is even though Klaus actually used the Facebook bunches of times, he was an early user of it, he never realized that I'd made it based on his idea. Klaus just never made the connection.
Do you want to hear my new ringtone?
Mm-hmm.
All right. It's so good. It's too good, actually. All right. Do you have your cell phone?
Yeah.
Call my cell phone. Get ready. Here it comes. Listen to this ringtone.
Search and destroy.
Yep. Isn't that the best?
Technology. Isn't that funny that I knew the song?
Yeah, but isn't that the best ringtone you've ever heard?
That's relevant, too. Look at the lyric. I didn't get it until you said it.
Right? Look out, honey. I'm using technology. Got no time to make an apology.
It's like a phone call in itself.
Yeah, and it loops. Not bad, huh?
Smoking.
Well, better be smoking, because that's my going to be my new job. I'm done trying to make more than one radio show a month. From now on, I'm just going to make ringtones.
You've made it too hard for yourself. you do all that editing and everything. That's why it takes you such a long time to put out a show, is you made too much work for yourself. When you are capable of turning on the microphone like I do and just do a freedom of association kind of thing and hope that it ties itself together. And
no.
You're talking a naturally conversant style.
No, I've got big problems here. I've totally lost the plot.
It might just be a slump. I don't know. Maybe that's bipolar.
Yeah, this is something worse. I know what a slump is.
That's the bottom line of mental illness, is that when you don't realize, when you're not self-actualized, once you're able to, like, just figure it out and know what's going on, that will set you free. The knowledge sets you free.
So, doctor, can you then maybe prescribe me something so I can get out of this so-called slump?
No, there's nothing you can do.
Nothing?
There's nothing you can do. You have to just wait.
You know what? I'm done with this consultation, doctor. I've got plenty of ideas. I got notebooks filled with ideas.
Oh, you still do?
Yeah, tons of them.
Then what are you complaining about?
I've lost the plot.
Did I ever tell you the most terrible thing that ever happened to me?
No.
All my books were stolen. Those idea books. I had all these wire ring notebooks. They were all colorful and it had all these like things taped to it and pictures inside of it. And they were really artfully done up, and they had all my ideas in them. And those books don't exist anymore. I've had several volumes of these for years and years. And it occurred to me several months ago that somebody took them. Somebody stole them from me. My own personal intellectual property.
Who would steal your idea notebooks?
Crackheads.
Why would crackheads want your books of ideas?
Because I left them in the apartment because I felt bad for them because they didn't have any place to live. And they know that I'm one of these suckers, that I have the wounded, what are they called? There's a name for it, the wounded pet syndrome. Like if somebody's ailing, that I always invite them in. You knew that about me, right? Remember I had that closet, the walk-in closet set up as an ulterior bedroom? And it would be the story of the snake, like the snake story in the Bible.
Mm-hmm.
You take the snake in and you nurse it back to health, and then all of a sudden, while you're feeding it tea by the fire, it reaches out and it bites you. And now you're poisoned and you're going to die. And the snake says to you, ah, but you knew I was a snake before you let me in.
So you're saying that the snake, the crackheads that stole your idea notebooks were biting you?
Yeah, something to hurt my feelings.
Ah, okay. So it wasn't like they thought they'd, like, grab these notebooks and then cash in and, like, sell them to Hollywood and then, you know, get a convertible and, you know, a crack warehouse.
It was done just to be mean. You can see, do you think most people have something like this where they have books of their ideas and letters and poetry, whatever? And, like, almost every individual, wouldn't you think, would have something like that or a collection of these things? And you know what they are when you approach them. And if you're a real bastard, like you're an alcoholic or some suffering delusional drug addict maniac, you'll know that this is a way to really get back at someone. You hate them because you're drunk and they just kicked you out or something like that.
So you take the notebook.
People are bastards to begin with. You know, it's not like I did anything other than let them in. And it didn't work out because they kept drinking or something.
Hmm.
And I had to ask them to leave. And the next thing you know, they're doing... turning violent or doing something like stealing my notebooks and just to ruin them.
I guess in a way I can relate to that, in that I let the internet into my life and together we started this radio show and, you know, I became the provider, you know, working 24/7 to get it done. But 2 years later now, the internet's turned into a total bitch. It's like there's all this drama because I can't get excited about the new app or the latest news platform.
Look, what you should do is change the show. Instead of these segments that you do and you're going all over the place to get these interviews, and it sounds kind of tough, it sounds labor intensive. Do you know you'll actually have a better show if you put no effort into it and just talk to me? You talk to me, and we banter back and forth.
Like every week.
Maybe a subject every week. And you won't even have to, like, be that informed, like, keep reading the internet to see what the latest news is to comment on. Just talk to me about me. Do a whole hour on me, or with me, or on me with me.
Okay. Sure, let's try it out. So, Peter, tell us what's been going on with you this week.
Here's what's been going on. Nothing. I've never in my life experienced nothing the way I have recently. Do I even made a resume to try to get a job?
What?
Why not? When was the last time I worked?
I'm wondering what possible kind of place you think would hire you.
Two words. The last word is store.
The dollar store.
No, the record store.
Well, there are no record stores left.
Oh, in L.A., we get record stores.
Really? So you're going to try to get a record store job?
They were so busy all day long. You wouldn't believe it because it's like, people shouldn't you be downloading at home and saving all this money? But they came because it's like a big event. When you come to L.A., you have to go to Amoeba. It's a big jungle in there. And I gave them my resume.
Do you think you'd get hired there?
Well, they didn't call me back. It's been 2 weeks that I've put my resume out there. I didn't call them either, though. I thought they would just see my name and call me. Oh, that's Peter Choice, the DJ? We got to call him. And I it's a little self-conscious making that resume because the resume has to say I am the greatest. But when are you overqualified for a record store? I mean, I've been on radio stations, and I proved to them I know the music, but they can't use me. I'm 52 years old.
You think it's age discrimination?
Nope, because I went in there and I saw gray hairs, a couple of them behind the counter. I mean, they're so busy, they do hire the gray hairs.
Yeah, but maybe those guys have just been stuck there, like they've been working there and they want to get rid of them, but they know they can't fire someone because the only reason would be they're old, but they can at least not hire someone who's old.
Oh, I was looking at it this way, that the hirer is old himself and wanted to give other old people a chance. It's Hollywood, you can still be good looking in 60. But they wouldn't put you behind the cash register if you were ugly.
Yeah, I guess that's true.
Not in this town.
So you're looking to fill the older guy, decrepitly handsome type niche for some poor record store owner.
Yeah, I can't, and I have a lot of pain. I can't stand up.
How are you going to work in a record store in pain?
You get the job first, you work out the details later. You tell them after they hire you.
I can't lift any records.
I can't stand and not this cash register. I need to sit. I'm in agonizing pain.
Yeah, I don't think this is going to work.
You know, the day you get hired, you just show up in your wheelchair. They can't fire you, right? You just show up in a wheelchair. Hi, you hired me yesterday. Here I am.
Yeah.
You love the minorities, don't you? Well, here's one for you to love even more. The wheelchair bomb.
The book that taught me everything a person needs to know about plot was Ernest Hemingway's The Sun Also Rises. I read this in my high school English class. According to the syllabus, we were supposed to read Hemingway's The Old Man and the Sea. But in the middle of my senior year, Mr. Shaker, our regular instructor of advanced English, took ill. And we got a substitute, Mr. Bell. Now, one of the first things Mr. Bell told us was that there was no way in hell he would be teaching us The Old Man and the Sea. In fact, he instructed us to cross it off our syllabus. And then, a few days later, he presented us each with a copy of The Sun Also Rises. I think he must have purchased these copies with his own money, because they did not have that textbook look or feel. Obviously, none of us had a sense of what a brave and subversive act this was. After all, we were just dumb 17-year-olds, unfamiliar with the policies of the Colorado public school system, which had long ago designated this book as inappropriate for high school pedagogy. But it was a dangerous book. In fact, this novel was directly responsible for 5 of my classmates losing their virginity. It also spurred a couple of threesomes, one with 2 boys and 1 girl, and another with 2 girls and 1 boy. And there was also a reading group where everyone would get rip-roaring drunk. This same reading group later in the year started a legendary riot at a swim meet, supposedly responding to some slur, but one of the participants told me the whole thing came down to a desire to act like a Hemingway character. These are just the incidents I was privy to. It's not like I knew everyone in my English class. I was by no means Mr. Popular. I was just a shy kid who kept to himself most of the time, lost in his own imagination. But this book, it blew my f***ing mind. Of course, Mr. Bell just wanted to teach us all about Hemingway's use of terse, short sentences and his iceberg theory and how the novel inaugurated this new form of writing, the modernist style. But for me, it all came down to something that happens at the end of chapter 17. Let me refresh your memory. At this point in the novel, the entire cast has now decamped from gay Paris to sunny Spain for the fiesta. Our narrator Jake Barnes, his friend Bill, Brett Ashley, the woman he loves, Mike, the man she plans to marry, and Robert Cohn, the Jew whom Brett has recently had an affair with, have all ensconced themselves in the Hotel Montoya in Pamplona. The fiesta is in full swing. Robert Cohn is bumming everyone out because he's still obsessed with Brett, even though she wants nothing to do with him. This affair has also ruined Cohn's friendship with Jake, as he also was in love with Brett. And then Pedro Romero makes his appearance. Now, Hemingway named his matador after one of the greatest bullfighters who'd ever lived, an obvious clue to how important this character was for him. In the novel, everyone stands in awe of this young matador. The aficionados profess their admiration, the American ambassador sends his regards, and Brett, well, she throws herself at him. And with Jake's help, she gets him into bed. This sends Robert Cohn over the edge, and in a jealous rage, he beats up both Jake and Pedro Romero. And that brings us to the end of chapter 17. Jake is waking up. The waiter tells him that a man named Vicente Girones, who was gored during the running of the bulls, has died. And then Jake tells us this. The bull who killed Vicente Girones was named Bocanegra, was number 118 of the bull breeding establishment of Sanchez Taberno, and was killed by Pedro Romero as the third bull of that same afternoon. His ear was cut by popular acclamation and given to Pedro Romero, who in turn gave it to Brett, who wrapped it in a handkerchief belonging to myself and left both ear and handkerchief along with a number of Marathi cigarette stubs shoved far back in the drawer of the bed table that stood beside her bed in the Hotel Montoya in Pamplona. Now, I can still recall reading this passage for the first time. I thought my copy of The Sun Also Rises was defective and that somehow the pages detailing the bullfight were missing. Eventually, I figured out what Hemingway had done. Speaking through his character, Jake Barnes, he broke the time frame in order to tell us what happened during the bullfight. But he does this before the action takes place. The next day, I tried to explain in class how, in reading the scene while knowing full well the conclusion, I had read in a way that I'd never read before. It was, I announced, a religious experience. But before I could say any more, Steve Perkins interrupted me. Steve was the guy who talked most in the class. He was also in a band and all the school plays. Everyone said he was a genius. He was one of Mr. Shaker's favorites. And you could tell he was trying to impress Mr. Bell as well. He scoffed at my outburst and exclaimed, "What's the point of reading something when you already know what's going to happen?" Now, I just want to quickly interject here and tell you that thanks to Facebook, I know that Steve Perkins never accomplished anything of note, never amounted to anything. Today, he's obese and he works at a cell phone store. But at the time, he was very intimidating, and so I slunk down in my chair and didn't say anything else. About 10 years later, I got to spend an afternoon in the archives at the JFK Library, where the original notebooks Hemingway used to compose The Sun Also Rises are housed. Hemingway based The Sun Also Rises on his own experiences. In the initial drafts, his characters are called Hem, Don, Duff, Pat Hadley, and Loeb. These were the names of his friends, the real people at the heart of his story. The people he took with him to Spain in 1925 to see the bullfights and experience the fiesta. It's not until he gets close to finishing the novel that he changes their names. But the most fascinating item I discovered that afternoon in the JFK Library archives was that the very first thing Hemingway wrote, the very first chapter of the first draft, it was a version of the bullfight. I don't need to tell you how central bullfighting is to Hemingway's work, but you might not know this. In the margins of one of those notebooks, he wrote, "Everything that happened in the ring was the truth, and everything else, fiction." In the pages of the Hemingway Review, a literary journal published by the University of Idaho Department of English, scholars regularly take up the meaning of the bullfight and the way in which Hemingway presents it to us. By far the best essay is the one Kathy Davidson wrote for the fall 1979 issue. In her piece, Death in the Morning, she notes that Jake Barnes gains his transcendent perspective just after he concludes his digression on the death of Vicente Terrones, the unfortunate reveler who was killed in the running of the bulls, felled, in fact, by the very bull Pedro Romero later slays in the ring. Now, for Kathy Davidson, it is this death, this sacrifice, that powers Hemingway's time shift. Another seminal essay is Tordeo, The Moral Axis of the Sun Also Rises, published in the 50th anniversary issue of the Hemingway Review in the fall of 1986. Writer Alan Josephs makes the case that Hemingway separates the bullfight from the rest of the novel because it is an actual religious experience. For Hemingway, the ecstasy of the matador is equal to the ecstasy of the religious. And while Joseph fails to address the narratological issue of the time shift, it is a damn fine essay, and one I wish I could have referenced as I wrote my high school term paper. Mr. Bell gave me a C- for this paper. He did comment on my enthusiasm for my project, but he also said he was profoundly disappointed that I did not choose to engage with the major themes of the book: the role of women, homosexuality, anti-Semitism. He advised I return to the book later in life and read it again, with the benefit of maturity. But his cruel C- failed to dissuade me. The seed had already been planted. I now knew that one could do battle with the inevitable. And win.
Once I understood plot after working, you know, for so many years, I knew I could convey that to other writers.
Martha Alderson is the plot whisperer. On her website, blockbusterplots.com, she boasts that she can help any writer unlock the secrets of plot structure. I called her up to find out how.
I have these two sort of major templates I use. One is to show plot at the overall story level, which is, I call it the plot planner. And the other is plot at the scene level, and I call that the scene tracker.
Oh, let's back up. Let's back up a bit. Like, let me try it this way. So, like, I'm coming to you.
Yes.
I'm a writer. I'm having trouble, and I need the plot whisperer. So, like, walk me through. Like, here I'm knocking on your door. Hello, my plot whisperer, help me. I need your help. I can't do this.
Okay. So I get contacted exactly like that, with people really desperate. I mean, either they...
Well, I'm desperate.
You know,
I am. Yes. I'm desperate. So we can just use me.
So then I just say, okay, I need for you, I'll send you a link to my website where it's a secret page where it's very simple. There's 10 items to fill out. And to me, if long as I know those 10 aspects of your main character, the protagonist, who is the character that's the changed the most by the dramatic action, then I can help you.
And yeah, but isn't it almost seem like plot can be like tyrannical sometimes? I mean, you talk about characters. I love good characters, and I love writers that create great characters. And, you know, it sounds like you do too. Like, why does it always, why do we always have to sort of be under the thumb of plot?
Well, to me now, plot is so much more than just a series of events. Plot is about a character being transformed over time by the dramatic action and what that means. You know, that the deeper meaning of that transformation, that without a character being changed or transformed, it's just the story doesn't have that richness and doesn't have the depth that's needed nowadays in order to really engage a reader long enough for them to, you know, sit through a whole movie or to read an entire novel.
I just don't have a lot of respect for plot. To be honest, I hate plot. Plot always seems to really frustrate me that that's almost what fuels most people's desire to read. It's to find out what happens. And I feel that plot gets in the way sometimes of writers and readers being able to ask the big questions about life and ourselves and our place in the universe. So it's, to be honest, I get really frustrated with plot. Plot seems like why we have so many crap books.
Well, sure. Because then the writer is relying purely on the dramatic action is what's driving the story. And that is, there is a place for that. You know, there are movies in the summer, blockbuster hits that are very reliant on special effects, the dramatic action, you know, bigger than life sorts of action that happens on the screen. There are what's called airport books, you know, the books that people buy when they are going to go on a long flight. They pick up a book at the airport, they read it, they leave it on the plane, they're asked later, oh, what was that story about? You know, I'm not really sure, I can't really remember. But the dramatic action is critical in a story because the only way we can see a character is how they react to what's happening around them.
Yeah, but what's wrong with a character who reacts to what's going on around them by shutting it all out, not changing? I mean, what if the story is a story about a guy who's a writer or a creative type who doesn't want to change? And, you know, that's the whole story.
Okay, well, that, well, so over time, if the character at the end is as stuck in the end as that character was at the beginning, the story is not going to be very satisfying to the reader.
It's not going to be very satisfying to the writer either.
Well, exactly.
I mean, he's the stuck one.
So it is that transformation from going from stuck to unstuck where the plot and the whole sense of satisfaction, reader satisfaction and writer satisfaction comes into play is when there is that moment of unstuckness.
So you're saying the audience and the plot whisperer all want the writer to change.
Exactly. And the universal story.
Huh?
You know, I believe that there is sort of this energetic flow that is happening around us all the time. And, you know, you see it in nature with birth and death. And, you know, it's just sort of this cycle that happens. That sort of energetic flow is moving us and we're evolving over time because of, you know, the things that are happening around us in nature and, you know, beyond just us as humans, but the whole, you know, planet and the universe itself.
So wait, this is what you tell people when they come to you for help?
Well, it depends. I'm kind of sensitive about that because a lot of writers that I work with are very left brain. They're very linear. They're very logical. And it is hard to talk about the universal story because people really do sort of roll their eyes and it sounds so, you know, new age or...
Yeah. But what if I'm just too stupid to understand the universal story? Does that mean that the plot whisperer can't help me? I mean, do you have plot consultations where it's just unsuccessful?
Well, I don't think I've ever had an unsuccessful one because I think the
So there's no one the plot whisperer can't help.
Right.
That's awesome.
No, I really believe that because I think that it's always right there in the story itself. And as long as the writer is open, as long as they're willing to listen and willing to try something new, then they can get to where they want to go. But, you know, for most of us, it's no outside force that's stopping us from getting our dreams. It's ourselves. It's our own sort of sense of self. And so my job then, if I'm not helping the writer get unstuck with their story, I'm sort of helping them a little bit get unstuck with themselves. You know, there's all of this sort of internal play that comes, you know, which is part of the writer's journey itself, is that you too, just like you're taking your protagonist through, you know, these set of challenges, a writer is going to go through very similar challenges. And if you're aware of those, you can see what the antagonists in your own life, what they represent. And in doing so, you can then work your way through them without getting so victimized by it and so stuck by it and, you know, give up and turn away from that which you really, really long for the most.
When you put it that way, though, it's like the plot whisperer is more shaman than story doctor.
Well, I think what it is being able to see the deeper purpose of, you know, of a story, but really life too. It's like beyond the material. It's, are we really only here to accumulate wealth and, you know, amass material objects and be externally beautiful and youthful forever? I mean, there is a deeper purpose, I believe, here, and that's beyond the veil. That's this sort of evolutionary impulse of wanting to grow and change and, you know, sort of learn more about our true essence. And if we can convey that in a story, or for the reader to learn it through a story, it allows the reader then on a deep and profound level to be moved and transform themselves and sort of empowered for them too, to sort of see the way clear that they can find meaning beyond the material.
So it turns out that it's not the priest or the rabbi or the imam who has the power to open the door to the other side, but it's the plot whisperer.
Yeah. Kind of funny, isn't it?
That is so awesome.
The first time you pick up Plato, it almost looks like a thesaurus, or it's like trying to make sense of a phone directory or something. It seems to have no apparent rhyme or reason at first.
Writer Paul Collins penned the introduction to the new edition of Plato, a 1928 reference book for writers in need of a plot.
Basically, Plato is it's a plot generator. It's this collection of plot elements that can be mixed and matched, and there's thousands of them. So the idea being that by putting them in all these various combinations, you have, practically speaking, some unspeakable number of of possible plot variations or combinations.
Plato was the brainchild of William Wallace Cook, but it wasn't something born out of necessity. Far from it. William Wallace Cook was himself a plot machine.
He was actually known as the man who deforested Canada. That was his nickname, just because of the insane output of books that this guy had, basically starting in the 1890s and right up through the 1920s and 1930s. He would crank out these short stories, novellas, and pulp novels. At one point, he wrote 54 pulp novels in a single year.
That's more than one a week.
Yeah. He had this just sort of amazing system of, there's no other way to call it, of manufacturing books, basically, and of manufacturing plots. And towards the end of his life, he started thinking about how can I sell the system itself, actually making a book out of that. And the way he goes about doing that is he has what he calls the master plot formula. There's an A clause, which is the protagonist, basically, B clause, which originates the action, and the C clause, which resolves it. And basically, the entire book is set up with a combination of those A, B, and C setups.
So the whole formula, everything gets boiled down to this formula, this three-part formula.
It is absolutely literally formulaic writing. I mean, not just as sort of a descriptive way of describing someone's writing. It is, he's literally trying to come up with a formula for writing and for plotting. So the way the entries are set up is that if you look at any particular plot twist within the book, it's preceded by a whole series of numbers, and it's also, it's followed by a whole series of numbers, and those numbers are potential situations that could lead up to that plot twist, and then the ones that follow are the ones that may follow that plot twist. So that basically allows you to determine what are the different combinations that can be kind of joined to that twist. This is entry number 1333B. And the A and B mentioned in this are the basically a two of the protagonists. A, with a hobby for collecting curios, presents B with an old hand-painted miniature. The miniature is of a beautiful woman framed in gold, containing a mechanism by which a needle steeped in poison is thrown out of the painted face. The miniature is to be worn next to the heart. So
this is kind of advanced.
He has kind of strange stuff in there. But basically, if you read that entry, it's preceded by a series of numbers, 1410, 1384, B, and A. And then it's succeeded by a whole bunch of numbers, 1461B, 1433C. There are all these plot elements that could be put before or after this particular one. So, you know, in theory, and a lot of these can be kind of almost endlessly daisy-chained into increasingly lengthy plots. So,
well, let's go forward and see what happens.
Sure. So, pick a number. We've got 1461B, 1433C, 1438B. What do you think?
1433C. 1438B, sorry.
1438B. All right, let's see. A, unknown to himself, has in his possession an object, X, which at any moment may bring death or disaster to him. A, unaware of his danger, is associating with people or is ignorantly dealing with deadly circumstances which may bring upon him a catastrophe at any time.
I see. So we have the object, the needle. Now he's wearing it, and he doesn't know he's wearing it, and he may be endangering other people around him.
Right. Or the other way, I guess you could read that, is he's given this object to this other person, B. He also possesses an object. So he's also walking around... A is also walking around with some incredibly dangerous object that they don't realize.
Oh my God, this is fascinating. So we should now let's go. Maybe we go back to 153.
Let's see, 153. A, in love with B, has a valuable gift sent to B by a jeweler. Through error or by evil intent, packages are transposed, and the gift received by B, as from A, nearly proves disastrous to A's love affair.
So if we're going to go with the needle here, the needle jumps out and kills, like, you know, his neighbor or a cop or
some other random customer of the jewelry store. Yeah.
Wow. All right. You know, it's we're kind of moving along with an actual story here.
Yeah. I mean, it does actually work in terms of generating plots.
So this book comes in the mail. You've been having some trouble. You open it up and you go back to your study. And how can this help you?
I don't think it can. I don't think it can help a writer. Let me put it this way. I think it might help a writer just in terms of the idea of playing with plot, playing with kind of crazy and random ideas. But one of the strange things about Plotto and plot generation devices is, and to be fair, Cook himself kind of points this out in the book too. He describes it as something meant to inspire a writer, but it's not really designed to be a replacement for writing, because it can't be. It's only a plot. Lots of people can come up with a plot, but not many people can execute it very well.
So what does this actually teach us about the nature of plot itself?
I think it says a couple of interesting things about plot. One is that that you do have the possibility for these sort of endless recombinations of elements of plot. That's something that I think writers realize pretty early on when they start working on plot and thinking about plot. But the other is actually the limitations of a book like this, which is that whenever you pick a particular passage, there are only three, four, you know, half a dozen plot elements that you can then choose from there, that they have to be believable. They actually have to make sense to some degree. And that strangely restrictive nature of it, I think, actually is a useful thing to think about in terms of plot. That once you've laid down a certain element in a story, it is determinative of what can follow next. To some degree, that's even true of nonfiction, in that if something truly unexpected happens, readers demand an explanation. And if the facts don't fit into a narrative, it'll often really throw them off. Just because something's true doesn't make it a story. And that's actually a real problem, I think, for a lot of nonfiction writers. You find something that is interesting, and it's interesting to you, but you can't figure out how to make it into a story. People bring fictive expectations to nonfiction. You know, they want believability, they want resolution, and when real life doesn't offer those things, they'll actually get frustrated with the writer or with the story.
Okay. Can we say then that while Plato might not be able to help fiction writers, it does turn out to be a handy reference tool for nonfiction writers?
Well, it's not a reference tool for nonfiction writers, but I would say that most people who work with nonfiction and have to work with a lot start to realize that there are certain plots that nonfiction stories tend to follow. Which is to say, maybe the better way to put that is that nonfiction stories that get published tend to follow certain paths. You can't have a story that's nonsensical. You can't have a story that is essentially plotless or seemingly aimless or doesn't resolve itself in some way. And in some cases, the person writing it almost has to force a resolution onto the story. In other cases, because they can't really figure out what the focus of the story is or how it resolves, it means that as a writer, you actually put that story on the back burner. You decide, I'm not going to pitch this right now because I can't nail it down. It just doesn't make sense as storytelling. Yes, the book is called Plato, and what I'm thinking is that we can use it to help you with your resume.
Oh, good, because I need help with my resume. It's like embarrassing.
What do you expect?
What I expect is that they see my name, and if they know me from the radio show, then they'll hire me, maybe. But that hasn't happened, or else they would have called back by now.
Do you have a backup plan?
No.
We're just going to have to go with mine. We are going to use Plato to plot your way to a record store job. What do you think?
So I have to write the resume in a certain format that's story?
Yes, we're going to plot your way out of your messed up life.
Yeah, I have to get out of this because...
Here it is. Look. A is unable to find a job and support his wife, B. A and his wife, B, find themselves face-to-face with starvation, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's where you are. Except you don't have the wife. But you could say the cat.
Right.
What's the cat's name?
Unshkinovich.
Unshkinovich. So, Peter is unable to find a job and support his cat, Unshkinovich. Peter and Unshkinovich find themselves face-to-face with starvation. So we can go to 523, 579, and 628.
Oh.
What do you think?
So they give you choices of how to proceed?
Yeah, but you know, there's some options that really...
I know it doesn't matter, but I'm not really afraid of starving because they still have food stamps. I'm afraid of other things, though.
Ooh, but exactly. You're afraid of this. A, Peter. So, that's you. Peter finds himself the only white man in a tribe of half-savage natives, okay? So, that would be like you in the record milieu, in the record store milieu. right? Uh-huh. They're not, you know, half-savage natives, but they're, you know, record store mutants. So uh-huh. Peter, finding himself the only white man in this tribe of half-savage natives, is compelled to struggle against their primitive superstitions. And that would be like you trying to explain that there's, you know, maybe other types of music than the kind that they like.
Uh-huh.
Like maybe like telling them about, you know, some of
Tuxedo
the
Moon.
Old yeah, Tuxedo Moon. Yeah, right? See?
Right.
Now we're getting somewhere. Now we have to go to 682 or 901. Let's try 682.
These corresponding pages, it shows you there, like what to...
Yeah, so here we go.
This is the dilemma. This is the possible solution.
Yes, exactly. We're continuing the story now. So Peter, the white man of brilliant intellectual attainments, in other words, he's been on the radio for many years. He knows all about Tuxedo Moon.
And I'm an intellectual.
Yep. Battles for existence.
That's a good way to get shot during the revolution, you know.
Battles for existence in an isolated, primitive, savage wilderness. Peter,
they
battling
the intellectual
for existence in this wilderness, suffers a deterioration of his character. So, like, maybe you start listening to Katy Perry?
Yeah, I'm just all of a sudden going to start listening to Justin Bieber. It's just going to be my new music taste.
Yeah, you suffer a deterioration of character until after some years, he sinks to the level of his primitive surroundings.
Uh-huh.
I don't see how that fits with the resume here, but here
that
we go.
That is not applicable.
Let's try 901. Peter is a white man who seeks to make his white civilization a pattern for half-savage peoples. Peter goes native. Peter goes native and marries a native woman.
That's a little bit of comedy there.
Wow, so I guess like you would like take the bad music from the record store, which you thought was savage, into like the alternative radio station and get that.
Yep.
You can see like how this could help, right?
Mm-hmm.
You're just saying that.
No, I don't see
it. I knew it. I knew you were not paying attention. And that is why you are not going to get the record store job.
You have to be more encouraging than that to me. Come on, you know.
No, I'm done. You are going to have to go out and buy your own Plotto book. Actually, there is one online. If you search for it, you can probably find it.
Well, yeah. I have to go to Google, man. Google, my Google. Google. Wow, there it is.
You found it.
I am so going to put this in my favorites where I never look, but it's going to be in there right in between End of Poverty Document and Non-Penetrative Sex. And Crystal Methamine Anonymous and Sex in the Public Bus. You ever see that? I should send that one to you. It looks real.
Please don't.
Exactly the kind of porn I always wished for. Shocked onlookers.
This episode of Too Much Information is called Losing the Plot. It was produced by myself, Benjamin Walker, with Bill Bowen and Sylvie Kovnat. It featured Paul Collins, Martha Alderson, and TMI regulars Peter Choice and Chris. Special thanks to Mathilde Biot, Julie Sabatier, and Rob Spillman of Tin House Books, who's just published the beautiful new edition of Plotto. There's lots more information on the TMI show page, and that's where you can subscribe to the TMI podcast as well. All that and more at WFMU.org.
You're listening to WFMU East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope, worldwide, WFMU.org. Up next, the Nardwuar, the Human Serviette radio show.
Dark.
listening to WFMU, and it's time right now for the Nardwar, the Human Serviette Radio Show. You just heard right there from Jimi Hendrix and Little Richard. Yes, Jimi Hendrix and Little Richard together, Keep a Knockin', with Jimmy on guitar and Little Richard on piano. And that's from the Friends from the Beginning LP, which was brought to my attention by Ian Mackay of Fugazi and Minor Threat. And today on the Nardwar to Human Serviette Radio Show, on the Nardwar to Human Serviette Radio Show, it's Ian Mackay from Fugazi, Minor Threat, Embrace, Egg Hunt, The Evens, you name it. Nardwar to Human Serviette versus Ian Mackay. Yes, I interviewed him in 2001, but here's a brand new interview from just a few weeks ago. As I mentioned, Ian alerted me to the world of Hendrix bootlegs, so I'm going to play you a bunch of them, mainly early stuff. Gonna continue on with something called Wipe the Sweat. It's from 1966. It's from an LP that just says Jimi Hendrix. Jimi Hendrix, Jimi Hendrix. Again, this is all stuff recorded before he went to England. So I don't exactly know who else is on the track, but we're gonna play it anyways. Wipe the Sweat by Jimi Hendrix. And then How Would You Feel by Curtis Knight and Jimi Hendrix. And now, to begin, gonna play No Business by Curtis Knight on vocals and Jimi Hendrix on guitar, all to prepare you for my interview with Ian Mackay. Here is, right now, Curtis Knight and Jimi Hendrix with No Business on the Nardwar, the Human Serviette Radio Show on WFMU.
All I got to my name is a beat-up guitar with three broken strings and a woman who just can't stand the way I sing. But it's a good way to bring in the rain. I just ain't take care. No business, no business. I just ain't. Pay my rent, he's gonna move his bed in my room. I even know the subway lady you're talking to, two. And my feet say it's time to buy a new pair of shoes. I just ain't take care. No business, no business. I just ain't take care. No business, no business. Now you know what, Jimmy? Get a gig if I can find a dime to buy some strings for this guitar of mine. But all this bending over, putting a kink in my spine, and I'm trying to have a good time. I just ain't take care. No business, no business. I just ain't take care. To bring back some bread.